the National Archives podcast series, DNA, Family History, and the Population of the British Isles, presented by Dr. Maurice Gleeson and Dr. Brian Swan.
I'm going to talk about autosomal DNA and specifically how it can be applied to help you research your own family trees. My name is Maurice Gleeson. I've had the pleasure of working with Brian on DNA for the last couple of years. And Brian has covered the Y-DNA test, which will take you back along your direct male line, and that has a reach of about 338,000 years. He's also talked about the mitochondrial DNA, and that will take you back along your direct female line, and that has a reach of about 200,000 years. Now, there's a third type of DNA test, and that's the one I'm going to talk about today, and that is the autosomal DNA test. And whereas the Y-DNA and the mitochondrial DNA take you back along the ancestral lines on either side of your family tree, the autosomal DNA test will look at every ancestral line in your family tree. The only problem is that whereas Y-DNA and mitochondrial DNA testing are very good for deep ancestry as well as recent ancestry, the autosomal DNA test is only good for recent ancestry, by which I mean in the last 210 years or so. And that's because as you go back further and further, the amount of DNA that you would inherit from any one individual ancestor gets diluted with each generation. So the reach of the autosomal DNA is about 7 generations. Now, there are 2 approaches to DNA testing. You can either undertake a fishing trip or you can ask a specific question, and I'll deal with each of those in turn. With a fishing trip, you just do the test, see what you catch. With a specific question, it's usually along the lines of, I'm sure we're related to that crowd and they have money. So that's the kind of question that you usually have when you're talking about a specific question. With a fishing trip, only you need to take the test. But if you have a specific question, it's usually you and somebody else that has to be tested. So there's financial implications for that. In terms of my own family tree, and this is a rough diagram of it, the question marks indicate potential ancestors. The blank boxes, whether they're squares or circles, indicate ancestors. I have no idea who they are, but I've managed to identify about 14 of my 32 great-great-great-grandparents. And I did the autosomal DNA test, and that takes me back around about 7 generations, including myself, to about the level of my 4 times great-grandparents. So that roughly would be would take me back to a common ancestor born around 1765. But the other thing that I've done is I've tested my dad, and because he's a generation further back than me, it takes me back an extra generation in our family tree to roughly a common ancestor born around 1730. And I've also tested my maternal aunt, and that takes me back on my maternal side roughly to about 1730. So if somebody matches me on my autosomal DNA test, I can say with a relative degree of confidence that we probably share a common ancestor sometime since about 1730. Very crudely, but that gives you a rough idea of how far the reach of the autosomal DNA test goes back. Now, if I've done my test with Family Tree DNA, and that is the company that most people will have tested with for genealogical purposes, a lot of people will also have tested with 23andMe, which focuses mainly on the medical risk assessment. So if you do test with 23andMe, you'll find that a lot of people don't respond to your emails, oh, I think we're cousins, please can we share information? They're not interested in the family tree side of things. But either company is a good company to test with. And here is the matches page on Family Tree DNA. You don't really need to see the detail, but they compare that with the population average. And so, for example, at the level of third cousin, you will have usually people share an average. It's around about 1.6%, for example. But there will be a range around that. It could be 1.3% to 1.9%. So on the basis of the type of or the amount of DNA that you share with your match, the algorithm with Family Tree DNA will estimate the relationship that you have. So you'll see with my results that I've got several potential third cousins up there. which would indicate that we share a common four times great. And I've got a couple of fourth cousins there. So that is the type of, that's what you get when you do the test. This is your match. And the first question, the first step in trying to ascertain, well, who is our common ancestor, is to ask the question, is the common ancestor obvious? And a lot of these matches will have put up their ancestral surnames, and you'll see them in the column here on the right-hand side. Some people haven't. These people here, so that's not very helpful, but some people have. And for example, this one down here, which is the Simpson surname, there is a Simpson in my tree, there's a Simpson in this tree, this could be our common ancestor. I need to email this person and say, hello, Family Tree DNA says that we are matches, the estimated relationship is fourth cousin, I see you have a Simpson in your family tree, so do I, let's share information and see if we can find out who the common ancestor is. Absolutely, yes. Yeah. This type of test can be done by male or female, and the match will indicate either a male or female common ancestor. Or it could be on my paternal side. I mean, in my particular tree, it's on my paternal side. But you won't know. If you have a match, you don't automatically know whether it's on your paternal side or maternal side. There's a variety of techniques that you can use to eliminate a lot of your ancestors from consideration in the match. And I'll come on to that in just a second. The other thing that some people do, and it's indicated by these dark blue squares that I've circled, is they've uploaded their GEDCOM with their family tree. And by clicking on that, you will actually be able to see the entire family tree of these particular people who have tested. So that can be very useful to seeing if you can locate the common ancestor. The second step in trying to ascertain common ancestors would be to start with your closest matches and send them an email and asking them if they'd be willing to share information, to share trees. And that's a very useful way forward. And obviously, I started with my third cousin, who was this lady, Peggy Baker, and she sent me a copy of her tree, and here it is in a bow tie chart, and I compared that with my own family tree, and we were immediately able to rule out ancestral lines which were highly unlikely to contain the common ancestor. There are several ways to do this. One of my favorite is, do you match each other on the X chromosome? Now, the X chromosome, if you're a man, I can only have received my X chromosome from my mother. Fathers do not pass on X chromosomes, they only pass to their sons, they only pass on Y chromosomes. So as a male, if I match one of these people on my X chromosome, it means that I have to be related to that person via my maternal side. So I can immediately eliminate all my ancestors on my paternal side. And that's a really, really useful way of doing it. Furthermore, there's only certain ancestral lines down which the X chromosome can pass. Because as you go back in your tree, as soon as you hit a male, you can't go back any further with your X because it couldn't have come through that male. It would have to come through his wife. And in so doing, the further you go back, you limit the number of ancestors that could possibly be the common ancestor. And finding a match on the X is a very, very useful thing to do. The only problem is that Family Tree DNA don't do X matches. They don't report matches on the X. You have to upload your results to GEDmatch and use GEDmatch, which is a publicly available database, to actually find out if you match people on the X chromosome. The other thing that you can do to rule out highly unlikely ancestral lines is to have one of your cousins tested. Have a cousin tested on the maternal side, have a cousin tested on the paternal side. If you match someone and they also match your paternal cousin, then you know it's on your paternal side. If they don't match your paternal cousin but they match your maternal cousin instead, then you know it has to be on your maternal side. You could cut down costs just by testing one cousin. So, for example, I will test a paternal cousin. If I and my paternal cousin match somebody, then it's on my paternal side. If the match matches me, but not my paternal cousin, then it has to be on my maternal side. So it's a bit like Sudoku. It's by a process of elimination, you can arrive at some very, very cogent conclusions. Now, Family Tree DNA does not report the X chromosome results. But if you load your raw data from Family Tree DNA and then upload it to GEDmatch, there is your X chromosome. And currently, that's the only way that you can analyze your X chromosome. There's a lot of pressure being put on family tree DNA to introduce an X chromosome browser or to include the X chromosome in their chromosome browser. Hopefully, that is going to come in the very near future. But for now, the only way of really determining if you have a match on the X chromosome is to download your raw data from family tree DNA and upload it to GEDmatch. Absolutely, yes. And with 23andMe, it's called Relative Finder. So Family Finder with Family Tree DNA. Once you've taken your ancestral tree and progressively eliminated certain ancestral lines, you're left with what I like to call, it's like a card game. You know, if you have a pack of cards in your hand, you can get rid of your maternal side, you match on the X, you get rid of a couple more ancestral lines. You're left with a shortlist of your ancestors. Now, you can then compare the shortlist with your matches shortlist, and hopefully you'll be able to determine, oh, it's either this particular ancestor here, or it's these ancestral lines. Because there's other things that you can do to rule out ancestral lines like ethnicity. You know, if your match has several lines that are Chinese and your ancestors only ever came from Devon, then it's highly unlikely that the common ancestor is sitting on one of their Chinese lines. So by looking at ethnicity and looking at nationality, you can further refine the shortlist of potential ancestors that are candidates for the common ancestor. The other thing that you can do then is to identify the matches that you and this first match have in common. So, for example, if you find that both you, and in fact in the case of myself and Peggy, we found that we had 15 other people who matched us on exactly the same segment of DNA, and that was on chromosome 8. And because these 15 people matched us on exactly the same segment of DNA, the theory is that it had to come from exactly the same common ancestor. So by contacting these common matches that Peggy and I share together, it might be possible to even bring more people to the card table, get them to repeat the process of eliminating unlikely ancestral lines, and then by showing our hands, we should, in theory, be able to identify the common ancestor or at least the common ancestral surname. That's step 4 in the process. And one can generate very interesting family tree charts based on the relationship of people together. And this looks like they're all, the candidates are sitting around a card table. And by looking at the relationship of every match to every other match around the card table, it's possible to construct a crude family tree diagram that can further inform you where this common ancestor sits. And that really is the approach to autosomal DNA testing when you're just doing a fishing trip. I think you'll probably appreciate from that it's a rather time-intensive procedure. It can be very involved, and I think a lot of people get so far and then give up, because either it takes up too much time or it's just too technically involved for people. So these are the big blocks and hurdles that we have to face at the moment. Hopefully in due course, as we get more automation in DNA testing, a lot of the steps in this process will become a lot more easy as time goes on. The other approach to autosomal DNA testing is to actually use it to answer a specific question. And to illustrate the use of autosomal DNA testing to answer a specific question, I'd like to tell you the story about the mystery of the wedding memento. And a couple of years ago, my dad was going through his grandfather's papers, and something fell out. It looked like a bookmark. But when he picked it up, it actually turned out to be a wedding memento. David Patterson and Ruby K. Gleason. They were married at Thorgominda on the 23rd of March, 1898. So my dad says to me, I found this, I have no idea where it's from, you know, do you want to investigate? So I said, sure. So I started off by Googling Thorgominda, and it turns out that it's in the middle of the Australian desert. So this is where Thorgominda is. It's a hot spring in the middle of the scorching desert. So the immediate question was, what the heck were they doing getting married in the middle of nowhere, virtually? So that led me on a quest. And over the course of the next couple of years, I managed to track down the descendants of Ruby Kathleen Gleason and David Patterson. But when I started off, I found out that from her marriage certificate, that parents were John Gleason and Anne Gleason. And I thought, well, fantastic, because my great-great-grandparents are John Gleason and Anne Gleason. Furthermore, Ruby Kathleen was born in Longstone. That was great as well, because all of my dad's grandfather's siblings were born either in Longstone, Killiscully, or Shillee, the neighbouring townlands. And there were other pieces of information that didn't match the two. Ruby Kathleen said that her father was a hotel keeper, whereas mine was clearly a labourer and probably never set foot in a hotel. And she was born around 1872, 1869, so were the siblings of my father's grandfather. And the story was that Ruby Kathleen went to Australia in 1886, which would have corresponded with roughly the time of the death of my John Gleeson. So maybe the father died, the children were forced to emigrate. And there was family lore that two of the children had gone to Australia, and there one of them had had a daughter who became a concert pianist or a singer of some renown. And after about 2 years or so, through Jeans Reunited, I was able to find the grandson of Ruby Kathleen, who was now in his 80s. And by emailing him, I found out that she came over to Australia with an uncle and aunt. She had a brother who was a famous baseball player in the U.S., and he had a daughter who was an accomplished musician, excelled at the violin. So there were tantalizing parallels between the two stories, but there was nothing that you could say was definite confirmatory evidence of a connection between the two families. So I convinced Alan to have a DNA test done. And we did the autosomal DNA test. And here's Ruby Kathleen. There's my dad's grandfather. If Ruby Kathleen and Martin were siblings, you'd expect them to share about 50% of their DNA. The percentage range would be 40 to 57%, roughly. If they were first cousins, you see the average percentage there with the range, second cousins with the range. And if it would mean that if Martin and Ruby Kathleen were siblings, then my dad and Alan would have been second cousins. So we waited for about 6 weeks or so, and the results came back, and they were... they shared 2.4% of their DNA in common. And this confirmed that there was a definite genetic relationship between these two people. And furthermore, it fitted the predicted relationship of second cousin. I also looked at mine was 1.4%, which would have been certainly within the range you'd expect for second cousins once removed. So this was an example of how, without DNA, we would have given up on this story a long time ago. With DNA, we established a genetic relationship, and it means that we are now spurred on to answer some of the remaining questions. For example, why did Ruby Kathleen change her name? She went over to Australia, because there wasn't any Ruby Kathleen in our family. There was a Catherine, there was a Winifred, there was a Bridget. And how did she get to the Australia? Can we find further information? So there's a lot of further research that needs to be done, but the DNA has helped confirm that there is a definite relationship there. So to summarize about autosomal DNA, it refers to all of your chromosomes, like we said previously, except the X and the Y. Autosomes are all of the non-sex chromosomes. But when you do an autosomal test, they do test for the X as well, so you will get the X chromosome up there. It has a reach of only about 200 to 250 years, so within common ancestor that goes back to 1700 or 1750 got a relatively good chance of picking up DNA match if you and another person have a common ancestor within that time period. It gets less and less the further you go back. So, for example, Family Tree DNA say on their website that the chances of you detecting a first cousin and a second cousin are about 99%. So if your second cousin tests, you've got a 99% chance that the result will come back and say, yes, you match this person. When you get to third cousins, it drops to 90%. When you get to fourth cousins, it drops to 50%. When you get to fifth cousins, it drops to about 10%. So you will only detect about 10% of your fifth cousins, 50% of your fourth cousins, 90% of your third cousins, but 99% of your second cousins, first cousins, etc. So it's very useful for connecting with fifth cousins or less. And the other thing that it provides, and we haven't talked about it today, is it provides ethnic admixture. And that kind of segues nicely into Bruce Winnie's talk, because he is going to talk about the... And that can be quite useful also because you can break it down by chromosome, the ethnic admixture of each chromosome, and that can be also quite useful in helping you decide where the common ancestor sits in your family tree with a potential match. So that's all there is to talk about autosomal DNA. Great. I will hand back over to Brian, who will talk a little bit about the next one, which is ancient DNA.
Yeah, if you appreciated, I said it's frustrating both of us, that, to be fair, that Bruce is not here, because I really just did plan for this as a bit at the end to sort of say, you know, where are we going to go from here moving forward. And I was going to say a few words about ancient DNA, because it's very much in the news at the moment. First thing to say really about it is ancient DNA will probably always be expensive and selective, because you need special labs to have it done. So to that extent, you know, utilising it in conventional family history, I think will always be pretty limited as to what you can realistically do with it. So it will be sort of specialist samples only. And historically, it's been applied to looking at mitochondrial DNA, but it's starting to become possible now to apply it to Y chromosome DNA samples as well. And there have been really three inventions that have changed the game. One is a technique that's called next generation sequencing. And this is really just being able to sequence DNA far, far faster. I'm sure you may have seen these graphs of the classic sort of Moore's law and the cost of sequencing it dropping down there. That's really just miniaturizing the whole of the DNA sequencing, and it's known generally as next generation sequencing. So it produces phenomenal amounts of data to do that. The other technique is a technique that's called DNA hybridization capture. That's actually tailoring small amounts of DNA onto the surface of particular glass beads to be able to pull out the DNA. The DNA in general that you're dealing with in ancient DNA is pretty severely degraded. It's normally less than about 100 base pairs that you're dealing with in terms of being able to sequence. So it's almost a numbers game. You sequence masses of these small numbers and use then very complex algorithms to match them back to get to the full sequence that's there. And again, that would not be possible to do that amount of sequencing without these next generation sequencing steps that are around. And the third one is SNP typing, which I don't know that much about, but again, it's to do with looking at specific markers that you can find on mainly on the autosomal chromosomes to pull out and characterise the bases that are there.
And this again is just
to give you some idea of the sort of ancient DNA fragment length. Those base pairs along the bottom give you a sort of distribution graph of what's around. So you get very few reads that are out in this part of the graph. Most of them are down here in the very short parts of the DNA that you have. And then you have to devise pretty complicated, and of course that's what takes the time, to combine these DNA sequences to sort out what's going on. And you hear people talking about coverage when you do these sequences of something like 5 times coverage or 10 times coverage or 50 times coverage. And that's the number of times you have to sequence these particular ones here and do the overlaps to build up the profile of what lies underneath.
And really the history of ancient DNA is if you go back in time for about the first 20 to 25 years, it was really all artifacts and everything else that you're measuring. But in the last 3 to 4 years, you're getting far better results out of what is going on.
Normally when you're doing these particular types of things, you have two primers, you have a target bit of DNA that you're trying to look at. And so you need a bit on the start and a bit at the end. And you need that about 20 base pairs. You need this about 20 base pairs. And the bit in the middle that's your target, about 30 base pairs. So you're sort of 70 base pair minimum molecule length. And if you remember that distribution graph I showed you before, it shows you the difficulty of using the normal type of PCR reaction to do this type of sequencing.
Using this other types of approach, you can avoid having to do that type of amplification.
The hybridization capture, which is really using these small sequences and pulling them out, it's targeted sequencing rather than shotgun sequencing. So you're actually pulling out the bit that you want from all the junk that's around in the rest of the sample that's there. In a very high throughput, up to several megabytes in a single reaction, lower contamination risks than in PCR, higher sensitivity than PCR with badly preserved sample, and replication of samples is possible. And I'm going to sort of partly guess the answer by telling you my story on Richard III at this stage, in that Richard III's been sorted out, at least on his mitochondrial DNA, and they're now trying, I know, to do his Y chromosome DNA. And there is one male line that survives from Richard III. It's essentially an illegitimate line through John of Gaunt that tracks ultimately back down to somebody who died in about 1820. I think he's the 5th Duke of Beaufort, and they found about 20 of his descendants. And so my gut feeling is they're using bits of the Y chromosome that they can pull out from his descendant to see if they can pull out Richard III's Y chromosome DNA using bits of this type of technology to get at that. So you're lucky in the case of Richard III that you do actually have a male line that legitimate that does survive down to the present day. Not so easy to do that on other members of other royal families that might come along. So SNP typing targets extremely short DNA fragments by the PCR if you can get it to do, you can get it to work. Interesting when a few SNPs define specific traits, coat colour, eye colour, can be potentially very useful for the Y chromosome. Y chromosome DNA, highly repetitive, hybridisation capture does not work. That's a technique of bonding it onto the surface. And for small data sets, cheaper than hybridisation capture, coupled to next genome sequencing. That's that.
New way of doing the DNA sequencing with massive coverage.
Is it always remains highly fragmented, mitochondrial DNA is usually easier, and the contamination risk is higher for some sample species than for others. And there is a time limit to ancient DNA survival.
This talk was recorded on the 2nd of May 2013 at the National Archives, Kew. This talk was sponsored by the Friends of the National Archives. This podcast is copyright to the National Archives. All rights reserved.